Hello and welcome to Martian Driving Podcast 106. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're looking at non-English language science fiction movies for the month of February. And the first two I've got are pretty damn good. The first one is a Mexican movie, Sleep Dealer, and the second one is a Spanish film, Time Crimes, also known as Los Cronocrímenes. So it's going to be Spanish language all the way. So sit back, I will get the contact details out of the way, and we'll get the show started. The Martian Driving Podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white, or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest to genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. Hey, how is everybody? I'm currently off on vacation, and I just spent 8 days in my hometown of Sydney with Sal, catching up with family, doing all sorts of things, and picking up a whole bunch of movie reference books from Gould's Book Arcade up there. And picked up a number of movies as well. If you go to King Street in Newtown in Sydney, if you happen to be around this part of the planet, you'll find that there's a ton of media out there. Gould's Book Arcade. There's a couple of really good DVD places. And, so I picked up a number of interesting things. Picked up a box set of Children of the Damned and Village of the Damned. A whole bunch of kind of obscure things as well. And it was very science fictional in a way because it was incredibly hot in Sydney. 38 degrees C most days. It was very, very humid. We took our nephew Billy to Taronga Park Zoo, which is one of the best zoos on the planet, if only for the location. It's right on Sydney Harbour and it goes up a sloping cliff face in terraces. And it's got the most spectacular views of the harbour. So we managed to wangle a free gold pass to see the zoo. And while we're there, it starts raining. So we take refuge in the reptile house. And the rain gets worse. And suddenly, Sydney gets a month of rain in an hour. It's pouring down, gutters are flooding, sudden waterfalls are appearing all over the place. All of the animals took cover, and we're stuck in a building full of venomous snakes, Gila monsters, Komodo dragons, and other things like that. So we kind of took cover, and then we went to the zoo shop and bought rain ponchos, tried to work it through, but we saw very few animals. Saw just some giraffes, a couple of Barbary sheep, the arses of a couple of zebras, and that was about it. There wasn't too much else. The seals seemed to be having a nice time of it, but nothing else did. So we ended up cutting the day short. But it was an adventure, and with a six-year-old child with you, anything that goes wrong turns into an adventure. So we all had a really great time. Of course, all of that other stuff I mentioned, where I picked up a ton of really cool media and reference books. I got a biography of Preston Sturges I didn't know about, a 1952 biography of Charlie Chaplin in paperback, any number of other reference books. Just had a great time with it. We drove up there, which is 800 kilometres, say 500 miles, 878 kilometres if you want to be exact. And we drove back again just 2 days ago. So had a really good time. I'm feeling very refreshed, ready to get on with a podcast. And just going to enjoy the rest of the week before I have to go back to the daily grind. So with all of that messing around up in Sydney, I haven't really had time to watch too many movies. We did watch two. One today and one while we're in Sydney. We saw Zootopia, which my friends who are in the furry community tell me is the Citizen Kane of furry movies. But, yeah, it was kind of okay. It's got a bunny rabbit and a fox and a whole bunch of other characters bouncing around a kind of anthropomorphized animal universe. It's not my kind of thing. I thought it was kind of okay, but it wasn't the Citizen Kane of any kind of movie as far as I could see. Though furries having a kind of sexualized view of anthropomorphized animals really see it as a different thing than I do. And I'm pretty sure that my six-year-old nephew didn't see it the same way that a furry would. Can you hear that in the background? Got some crickets outside the window. That's a Silver and Gold reference, actually. And hi to Alex and Zom. So I saw Zootopia. It was okay, but as I said, not my glass of tea. And there go those crickets again. The other thing I saw was something that I picked up on DVD, which I had to get imported from America because that's how things work, unfortunately, when you live on the bottom of the planet. And it's a movie from the 1960s, a crime caper film starring Gary Lockwood, Elka Summer, Lee J. Cobb and Jack Palance, called They Came to Rob Las Vegas. It's a really weird one because all of the second unit work was done in America, but the rest of the film, including the primary actors, was done in Spain. So it's got a kind of contradictory mise-en-scene because of that. The establishing shots are quite nice. It's interesting, always interesting to see places like Times Square or Las Vegas as they were in the 1960s because they're very, very different than they are now, of course. But it was kind of a crime caper film that was sort of enjoyable. I think it may have needed a little bit of an edit and a little bit of a tightening up of the script. But you get a little cameo as well from Jean Gervais, who we remember as Le Stéphanois in the classic French Jules Dassin crime film Rififi. He turns up at the start of the film as well, so that was kind of cool. But yeah, it's very much a 60s caper film and kind of interesting for that. A lot of people get shot, which is always fun. And I did kind of enjoy that, and I'm glad I bought a copy. I got it very cheaply on eBay, which is kind of good. If you are interested in collecting films rather than just streaming them or downloading data for your films, you do worse than just, you know, look around eBay. Keep your mind open on what you can get. What I normally do to kind of narrow the field a little bit, and this is just a tip for if you're interested in that kind of thing, is I type in cult Blu-ray and I go cheapest price downwards and scroll through all of the shit until I find something that I want to buy, and I buy it. So that's the way I do it, and I can pick up some very cheap things, including free postage from overseas. I'm not sure how people wangle that, but there are a lot of countries, America and England in particular, and also Malaysia, where you can get cheap free postage to Australia. And it takes about 2 weeks, but it is kind of cool to be able to access and legally access some movies that you might not be able to get otherwise. I actually got a free torrent of They Came to Rob Las Vegas about a year ago and watched it. But the kind of movies that I want to see a couple of times, I tend to want to buy when I can afford it. And this was one that I could afford, so I did it. I kind of like the idea of owning media. I've talked about this a little bit before, but you can't, if you have something streaming on Netflix or Stan or any one of those other platforms, Hulu in America and the rest, rights can change and they can be withdrawn from you. So basically what you're doing is renting the possibility of watching a number of films. Whereas if you buy a disc, what you're getting is one particular film, but unless your house burns down or you get robbed, it can't be taken away from you capriciously by the rights owners. So I kind of like that idea, which is why I've got a room wall to wall with DVDs and Blu-rays at the moment. But anyway, I digress. It's time to start talking about the two movies that we're doing for this podcast. The first one is Time Crimes from 2007, a time loop adventure with four people in the whole movie, which is kind of interesting. And then we get on to one that I've been asked by a couple of different people to do for the podcast, and that is the 2008 Alex Rivera-directed futuristic movie, Sleep Dealer, which is, in a weird sense, even though it's less than a decade old, sort of a lost film. But anyway, before I do that, I'm going to play some nice, cheerful music for you from the soundtrack to the movie The Impostors, which is one of my favourite comedies at the moment. I actually picked up the soundtrack on Amazon quite cheaply. And this is a kind of cool little retro piece. It's actually called I Get Ideas, and it's sung by Elizabeth Bracco and Louis J. Stadler from the movie The Impostors, which you've got to see. It's a funny little film. Stanley Tucci, Oliver Platt, Tony Shalhoub's in it, Billy Connolly, all sorts of people, Alfred Molina. But anyway, here it is. And as science fiction is the genre of ideas, it seemed apt to do a song in the podcast called I Get Ideas. But they're not really scientific ideas.
You're dancing and you're dangerously near me. I get ideas.
I get ideas.
I want to hold you so much closer than I dare to.
I want to scold you cause I care more than I care to.
And when you touch me in this fire in every finger, I get ideas.
I get ideas. And after we had kissed goodnight and still you linger, I kind of think you get ideas too. Your eyes are always saying
the things you're never saying.
I only hope they're saying
that you could love me too.
For that's the whole idea.
It's true.
Lovely idea that I've fallen in love with you. Your eyes are always saying
the things you're never saying.
I only hope they're saying
that you could love me too.
Well, that's the whole idea.
It's true.
Lovely idea that I've fallen in love with you.
And from that we go to quite a dark and twisted little time travel movie from 2007, directed and also starring an actor called, and director of course, called Nacho Vigalonga, who's done a couple of other science fiction films in Spanish that I really have to check out at some stage in the future, because there's a kind of line of Spanish language science fiction movies that I really should pick up on. I've got to kind of get outside the comfort zone of genre and look at things that other cultures are doing, because, you know, that expanding of your interest and expanding of something that you're interested in is always a good thing. Now, this one features a middle-aged man called Hector, who is living with his wife in a new house. They've just moved in there, and they're doing a lot of renovations to him. Hector just seems to be a bird watcher because he's got a nice little deck chair in the back garden and has a pair of binoculars. And one day he's sitting in the back garden and sees some unusual things in the forest behind the house. First off, he sees a woman undressing, a young woman undressing, which, being a middle-aged man, he focuses on, and is interrupted by his wife. And then when his wife's interruption is over, he sees a mysterious man in a long coat whose head is covered in pink bandages. And he obviously thinks that the young lady's imperiled by this guy. And so he goes down into the woods, and things start getting very strange. He sees the woman lying unconscious against a rock, naked, and then unexpectedly he's stabbed in the arm with a pair of scissors by somebody he doesn't see. So he flees again, and flees to a nearby scientific establishment where he meets a scientist played by Nacho Vigalonga, who, you know, he's being chased by a madman, obviously the guy with the bandages and the long coat. And he asks the scientist to help him take sanctuary. And so the scientist gets him to hide in a tank full of white liquid, puts a lid on the tank, and it's just going on evening. Hector is in there for what he thinks is a second. And when he comes out, it's daytime. He's gone back over an hour into the past. And this scientist is actually working with a facility that's developed a time machine. And Hector is the first person to successfully use a time machine. So he's gone back in time and he's given the opportunity to kind of rescue the young woman from this mysterious masked person. And then as the film progresses, things get darker and darker. And we find out that the man in the mask is actually Hector himself. Now, this is not too much of a spoiler because it's in the trailer for the film. And there are multiple versions of Hector that are time looping around that particular day in order to prevent certain actions from happening, which I won't spoil because they're the guts of the film. Hector's got to try to resolve the problems in a way that, first off, allows him to go back to his wife and not live in a world with multiple versions of himself. So on the second iteration, he has to do things exactly the way that they went in the first loop so that his previous self will get into the time machine so there won't be two versions of Hector in the universe. So this leads him down a very dark path. He gets injured a number of times. He becomes the man in the bandages, and he performs some acts that he knows are necessary to kind of maintain the purity of the timeline so that things aren't disastrous. He takes some actions which are against his own moral code and which affect other characters in a number of ways. Now, I'm being very vague and oblique about that, but deliberately, because there are some twists and turns of this film that are best experienced rather than told about on a podcast. Now, the acting in the film is particularly good, particularly a guy called Kara Elijalde, who plays Hector. He's a fine actor. He's been acting in film, at least, since the 1980s, and he's kind of a slightly paunchy, balding, middle-aged man, and not particularly scientifically literate. But he suddenly finds himself in the guts of this science fictional situation where he's gone back in time and he needs to change events and yet maintain the purity of the timeline because he wants to get back to his wife and resume his life. And if he doesn't ensure that his previous self gets into that time machine, then that won't occur. There'll be two versions of him. And because Hector's quite an insecure guy, he thinks that his wife's going to prefer the other version of him, which kind of makes things very cool and interesting. Now, his wife is played by an interesting actress called Candela Fernandez. And the young girl in the forest is played by Barbara Gonaga. As I said, the scientist who puts him into the time machine for the first time is played by Nacho Vigalongo. I apologise if I mispronounce names there. Now, the movie has echoes of other films in it as well, inevitably, because films are influenced by other films. There's a little bit of Rear Window in the original voyeurism of Hector sitting on the deck chair in his garden with a pair of binoculars. And rather than as James Stewart's character in rear window, he immediately, rather than reluctantly, gets involved in things. He's a man with good intentions, but maybe not the sharpest pencil in the box. And also he's not very good at thinking things through sometimes, but the situation forces him to think things through and to understand the nature of the time loops and the things he has to do to make things right. And in doing so, in the act of making things right, he has a profound effect on at least one of the other characters in the film. In fact, two of the other characters in the film. And one of the lovely things about the film, too, is as things progress and as Hector goes through the time loops, he gets injured in various ways. There's a couple of car accidents he gets injured in. And, of course, being stabbed in the arm by the mysterious assailant who's actually his future self. So as things break down in the moral compass that Hector has, Hector himself ends up being physically injured as well. So it kind of reflects the breaking down of his moral compass is reflected in the physical damage that's being done to him by the actions that occur in each of these time iterations, which makes it kind of cool and very, very interesting that physical manifestation of Hector doing some quite monstrous things in order to preserve, first off, his wife, and secondly, to make sure that things occur in a way that lets him fix what's gone wrong. So this movie kind of works on a number of levels. It's a character study in some ways. It's one of those movies where you see a threat to domesticity, which is always a strong thing in this kind of thriller. And yeah, there are suspenseful parts and there are thriller parts. There are things Hector does that we find morally repugnant, unless you're a total fucking psychopath. And yet we understand why he's doing it. His motivation is always clear to the audience. This is one of those movies that really does bear paying close attention to. The more you pay close attention to this film, the more you're going to get from it, because there are things that occur that seem random events but actually aren't. They're actually actions by different iterations of Hector, and also the actions of the scientist, who doesn't get a name in the film, but is an instigator and also a reluctant participant in things that occur. And so, yeah, it's a really interesting film. It starts in one place and goes to a very different place and ends on a morally dubious ending. As I said, one of the characters does pay a high price for the time looping that goes on. And I've got to be careful when I gesture not to bash the keyboard. Nacho Vigalongo said that he based the movie on 2000 AD comics, which were a bunch of comics that came out in the 70s and 80s from the UK, and they had people like Alan Moore writing for them, and they were just kind of off the wall, in a lot of cases off the wall science fiction comics. Of course, the comics are now very collectible, and if you have some of them, then you can monetize them quite easily if you choose to do so. Time loops are an interesting thing in the film. Of course, Looper had time loops. And I've talked about a couple of other movies that have time loops in them on previous Martian Drive-In podcasts. Amongst others, very early in Martian Drive-In, I talked about an Australian film called Triangle, which has some interesting time loops in it. And then, of course, there's Primer, which I talked about with Ian Mond. And so, yeah, I think there are going to be various time loops of this plot that are going to be in the future of cinema. There was a recent Netflix movie called Arc, ARQ, which has time loops in it as well. It's a really nice kind of thing. It lets you make a movie on a fairly limited set, because as you loop back, people go to the same locations. And you can film it from different angles. So it's a good intellectual exercise for a writer and director, and also for actors as well, because if they've got to do different iterations of themselves, there's a discipline and a focus that's required to do that in a movie. And in this movie, it's done very well, by the way. So I expect to see more movies with time loops in them. in the future, because it is a kind of science fiction film that you can make with limited budget, limited numbers of actors, and limited sets and locations. So it's always going to be attractive to somebody who wants to make a fairly low budget but interesting science fiction film to use that particular trope. Of course, in the hands of a bad writer and bad actors, it's one thing. But when you've got somebody that tries to think outside the box, within the box of a time loop movie, then you're going to get interesting things like time crimes as a result of that. It really is worth seeing. And that morally ambiguous ending troubles me to this day. I really don't know what the next thing that's going to happen to the characters is going to be. But whatever it is going to not be a happy ending, as far as I can see. It really is a troubling ending. So let me know what you think if you've seen Time Crimes and how you feel about the ending, because for me, it's problematic, and I think that's, nonetheless, it's the right ending for the film. Now, I don't want to give it away, so I'm kind of being vague and ambiguous about what I'm saying there, but an interesting ending nonetheless. So anyway, I'm going to take another break, and when I get back, we're going to talk about a much more sort of reality-based science fiction movie, which has aspects of old-school 1980s cyberpunk about it, and yet has some themes and a future, which over the last year or so has become creepily plausible, and that is the 2008 science fiction movie Sleep Dealer, directed by Alex Rivera.
We build your skyscrapers, and we harvest your crops. We even protect your property. Let our robotics do your dirty work. Safe, reliable, we make America strong.
His name is Nemo Cruz. At first, I didn't think much of him. Just another node worker, risking everything to connect to the other side. He was one of millions. That's until I got a strange call.
I will pay for any information on him.
What's in his past? What is he hiding?
Memo. Tú no me conoces, pero yo a ti sí.
Somewhere in his past, there just might be hope for our future.
Sleep Dealer is a 2008 Mexican science fiction movie, directed, as I said, by Alex Rivera. It stars Luis Fernando Peña as Memo Cruz, a young man who grew up on a very impoverished small village in Oaxaca, in Mexico, where large corporations have stolen the local river and dammed it, and the locals have to buy the water from those people who have robotized machine gun emplacements that sell the water to the local people so that they can barely subsist on the small rations that they can afford to buy. The water's sold to them at an inflated price. Most of it goes elsewhere. The suspicion is either to large cities or across the border to the United States of America. When Memo's father is killed by a drone strike, because he's perceived by the US government to be an aqua terrorist because he's been trying to get the water for his family. And the US government has also detected memos tapping into local phone calls and things like that to find out about the greater world. Memos in a small and very impoverished way, a bit of a hacker. So when his father is killed in a drone strike, Memo decides to go to Tijuana and get a job as a node worker. Now, nodes, I just get that. I've got a little nice little piece on this, which talks about, it's from the Washington Post. And here's what it says. The character Memo Cruz, played by Luis Fernando Peña, leaves the barren fields of his farming village in Mexico, where the water has been dammed by a corporation for use elsewhere. He goes to Tijuana, where he seeks a coyote, a play on coyote, who smuggles undocumented immigrants into the United States. The coyote gives him a node job, so he can become a sabrecero. The nodes implanted in his muscles, along his arms and across his back, allow him to plug into one of the virtual factories in Tijuana, where workers make the physical motions that remotely control robots in America. The robots are constructing skyscrapers, cleaning houses, cutting grass, doing all of the jobs that illegal immigrants previously did, before this very cyberpunky future. This is the American dream, explains the character. We give the United States what they always wanted. All the work without the workers. So, Memo is getting paid a lot more than he would in the village, and he sends money home to his parents. He lives in a little shanty in the hills outside Tijuana and works in the sweatshops of what they call sleep dealers, the people who sell the physical actions and the sobreseros to the Americans who use them to construct skyscrapers and do all of the scut work that the Americans don't want to do. As he enters Tijuana, Memo meets a woman called Luz, played by Leonor Varela, who's a writer, and she makes ends meet by using her nodes to upload her memories online and selling them in a kind of eBay way on an open market. She makes friends with Memo and finds him a very interesting person. He seems a very intense and proud man, and something about that attracts Luz. Now, so the memories she gets about Memo suddenly have value, and somebody decides to buy the memories that Luz has of Memo and about his life and about his past and about him becoming a sabrecero and living in Tijuana and sending the money back to his family. The whole story of Memo is interesting to one person, and we only find out a little bit later who that person is. And ultimately, when we do find out who that person is, it gives Memo and that person an opportunity for redemption. It allows Memo, with the help of this person, to ultimately strike back at the big corporations and the rich people in the north who are taking everything, including their life, away from the people living in Mexico who work for them. And in a small but important way, they strike back against those people and have, even if temporarily, a victory against these immensely powerful and immensely technologically powerful people who use them and drain them and drain the resources of their country. So it's a really interesting film from that point of view, because there's a lot of real politics in it. In 2008, when it was made, Sleep Dealer got a raw deal. The reason it got a raw deal is the distribution company that released the film, after it was quite successful at the Sundance Film Festival, suddenly went broke. And so the distribution deal fell apart. And for 6 or 7 years, this became almost a lost film. It was hard to get a legal copy of. Nobody took an interest in it. It was a fine piece of cinema, a fine piece of science fiction cinema. But it was one of those ones that fell down the cracks because of misfortune. But then something interesting happened. The Sundance Institute went to bat for Sleep Dealer And they ended up financially supporting it for here's what it says in the Washington Post. Washington Post. They would facilitate digital distribution deals with iTunes, Amazon, and Netflix to give some oxygen to this very important film, because it's about the immigration issue between the United States and Mexico, and it became timely again with the rise of Trump and all that bullshit about the wall. And so this movie, made in 2008, but Alex Rivera had been writing it as far back as 1998, was talking about the way that a large superpower drains the countries around it, or at least the one to the south, and the way it treats immigrants and undocumented workers as less than human. And we see a lot of this in Sleep Dealer as well. When Memo goes to the factory, there can be feedback through the nodes when workers are kind of telecommuting, in a sense, to the United States of America, and people get injured. They get blinded because they get feedback through the contact lenses they wear, so they can see what's going on the other side of things. They get electrical surges through the nodes into their bodies, which can cripple them. And there's no medical support for them should that occur. And in fact, when we see Memo in his little shanty outside Tijuana, there are a couple of blind old men who quite clearly were blinded working in these factories for the sleep dealers. And all they can do is just sit around, drink and talk about, tell stories about things. And they seem to be quite enjoying it. They're poor and they're living in a tiny shanty, but they tell stories to each other and tell stories to other people. And that cultural network is another underlying theme of this movie as well, the networking between people in rural communities. Even though Memo wants to leave as soon as he can, this tiny little dried-out village in Oaxaca, where he grew up and where his father, because he owned a bit of land, was a very important person on the small world that he knew from his childhood upwards. But that sense of community and that sense of having your own future and not the one that's determined by the cruel, grinding machinery of economics is an important theme in this movie. Memo is aware of the fact that even though he's supporting his family financially, this isn't the life he should be leading. He, even though he hated it while he was there, as time goes on, as he works in the factory and as he talks to Luz and they fall in love with each other over the course of the film, he gets a sense of where his place is and what his world is. And he takes steps with the assistance of Luz and a mysterious third party that I won't go into because I don't want to make it a spoiler. They decide to strike back and give Memo and his community a chance to have their own destiny. And, this is a beautiful film. $2.5 million it cost. The budget's nothing, really. And yet, it talks about important themes. Science fiction is the genre of ideas and the genre of what if. And this movie really does ground science fiction. It's a fairly near future, and it also talks about profoundly important issues, which have become the pointy tip of a lot of discontent in the world these days. The 1%, the problems we have with capitalism being broken by the way that it's manifested, the oligarchies that are forming, the way rich men manipulate the poor, and even those who are middle class, how they've been drained and ripped off by the wealthy and by neoliberalism in particular, and how so much human potential and the opportunity for humanity to go in a different direction is wasted because of the weird lottery of where people were born and in which circumstances that now determines the opportunities they get in life and the chances they get to learn and to enrich the world. There's so much wasted human potential. This movie is about wasted human potential in a way. Memo is an intelligent man. He's a determined man. He's a strong man in his own way, even though he's kind of unworldly when he first reaches Tijuana. He's a man who stands up for his family, stands up for what he believes is right, and realizes that if he continues working as a sobrecero, he will be drained. His life is drained by the grinding, difficult work that he does, which potentially will cripple and blind him if he lets it continue for too long. So he's a man that's kind of cornered by that cruel machinery of economics in a way. And yet he finds, through the building alliances with other people who are marginalized, Luz is a good writer, but she has to sell her memories in order to make a living rather than writing. And the third person himself is manipulated and used by the other side of things in order to keep the status quo in place. Now, we see a lot of near futures in science fiction films, but for the most part, because, of course, of again, that great economic machine that is America, we see it mostly from an Anglo point of view, and also from a point of view of the USA. And what this movie does, and one of the reasons why it's such an important film in some ways, is it shows the other side of things. It shows a cyberpunk, high-tech future from the viewpoint of a Hispanic underclass in Mexico whose efforts enrich people north of the border, which they can never get to. Now, there used to be a trope among science fiction writers that science fiction cinema is 20 to 30 years behind science fiction novels and stories, because for whatever reason, cinema, it's always that little bit behind. They didn't hit cyberpunk until well after it started, for instance. They were doing space opera with Star Wars in the 1970s, where space opera was a product of the 1950s. So, you know, there's always that kind of lag that exists with science fiction cinema as opposed to science fiction novels. And in a sense, Sleep Dealer very much feels like a 1980s cyberpunk movie in some ways. The fact that everybody's got all of the sobreceros have these nodes in them and are physically hooked up through fiber optic cables to the machinery that transmits their attention and their effort to the United States. That's a very 1980s thing, having those wires. It's a very cyberpunk thing. Cyberpunk was about wires and modems, where these days everything's wireless. So, in a sense, it's a slightly retro-feeling future in some ways. They're visually, these fiber optic cables almost acting like puppet strings for the workers is a striking image. And from a visual point of view and from a visual science fiction point of view, it really works. In fact, the DVD cover of the Australian DVD release of Sleep Dealer shows Memo from behind with four of the nodes and with the cable sticking out of them. Sticking out of his back. So in some ways, Memo's future is a kind of old-fashioned future. But in other ways, with that issue of immigration and issue of third-world exploitation by large corporations, it has also a very contemporary feel. The technology is retrograded. The sociology is cutting edge in this film. And that's one of the things I like about it too. Science fiction movies are okay. I love the ones that are about spectacle. You know that. I've talked about it before in the podcast. I'm a big Marvel geek. I like the spectacle of a Marvel movie, for instance, and a whole bunch of other films. But then there are smaller science fiction movies that are, in a sense, are more important, even though they never make a hundredth as much money as one tentpole Marvel movie will. In spite of that, they're kind of important movies. And a movie like Sleep Dealer is one of those ones that people are going to look back on in 20 years' time and reappreciate. In fact, it only took a few years for the Sundance Institute to do that, but it's going to happen again. Sleep Deal is one of those movies that's kind of a touchstone for the zeitgeist, in the same way that a movie like A Face in the Crowd has had a resurgence because of the rise of Trump. There are movies that are cautionary tales, and this one indeed is a cautionary tale, which later on are appreciated. And I think this one's definitely one of those movies. It's a cautionary tale about the exploitation of the poor, the exploitation of non-white people by an overwhelmingly white society, and also about the small but important ways in which people fight back against that monstrous machinery I talked about earlier. And one of the other important things about this film, which I just realized, I just flashed on this, is that all of the stuff set in Mexico is location. So you have the dusty little arroyos of the village and the small crops that Memo's father grows, and the dam and the dusty little town, which in some ways reminded me of the village in The Magnificent Seven. And then you've got Memo's viewpoint as a construction robot of the American city, which is never mentioned which city it is. Could be LA, could be New York, we just don't know. But we see that through his eyes, and that's all CG. So even though Memo's working there, the America he sees is a computer construct, whereas the world he lives in has a vividness about it. The location shooting in the markets in Tijuana and in the streets and the poor little shanty on the outskirts of the city, and Memo climbing a hill with the lights of Tijuana in the background, all of that has a vividness that for his character just doesn't exist in the America he sees. And when the other character is seen in America, we see most of him either driving a car or in the home of his family. So in a sense, we never really see America in this film. All we see are a poor person's perception of it seen through a cybernetic interface for the most part, and also a marginalized person visiting his family for the most part. So that's kind of interesting too. As I said, very small budget movie, but it shows that when you've got something to say, budget doesn't really matter too much. You get some good actors together and all the acting in this is fine. You have your idea and you follow it through to a logical conclusion. Now, if this were a USA film, for instance, Memo would find a group of hackers who would smash the system and stick it right up the capitalist system that's manipulating him. But that doesn't occur in this film. The victory that he has is small, but it's important. And that's kind of good too, because it shows that the movie has realistic goals. It doesn't have overwhelmingly unrealistic ambitions for its characters. The stuff that they do and the actions that they take are on their scale. They're not kind of world-changing, they're life-changing for a small number of people in a small village in Oaxaca. And that's kind of cool too. I like the fact that they stepped away from going with the obvious and went with something that's much, much more satisfying. I really like that part of the film. But just to wrap it up for Sleep Dealer, see the film. It's coming out on the streaming services. If you're in Australia, you can pick up a DVD of it from places like JB Hi-Fi. I got mine for like $6, $6.95, I think it was, which is a tragedy. But nonetheless, that's what it costs, because people don't know about this film. And one of the things I wanted to do in talking about it is get the word out that you've got to check this film out, because it's important, it's good, and it's crazily timely. And that has an attraction to those of us who kind of understand what's going on and are appalled by it in the world scale. But anyway, that's about it for Sleep Dealer. Thank you to all the people who recommended it to me. I really appreciate that. That kind of cluing me in about these kind of films is good. I pick up on a lot of things, and I try to cover the waterfront pretty well when it comes to genre films. But there are always going to be things I miss. And that's where the lovely, supportive and wonderful audience that I've got really does make this work. So anyway, we're going to wrap it up. As usual, the two Kerrys are important. I'm going to have to kind of retrofit that the credits again. I really apologize that I haven't, even though I've been promising to for a number of months. Real life gets in the way sometimes, and as a primary carer for Sal, sometimes there are other priorities that I have. But anyway, look after yourselves. Enjoy good films, enjoy bad films, enjoy any film you like. I've got to rewatch La La Land tomorrow because I'm doing it for the radio on Thursday, and I'm kind of looking forward to that because La La Land is going to clean up at the Oscars. And as they said on Saturday Night Live recently, La La Land is the kind of movie that white people go to. Anyway, look after yourselves. Keep watching those good films. Keep watching the bad films. Keep watching the skies. And I'll be back again. And here, of course, as always, in great admiration and respect, are the credits for the podcast, just name-checking and giving film roles to all of the people who support the podcast via Patreon. Catch you next time. Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers, and here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, our caterer, Grant, our technicolor consultant, Claire, our script doctor, Gary, our prop master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, the location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve, our script doctor, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Kerry, our second script doctor, Richard, our set photographer, and our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. And let's not forget Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, and Richard C., our transportation co-captain. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.